Two armed gunmen opened fire on people celebrating Hanukkah at Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia. At least 12 people are dead and nearly 30 more wounded, including children and police officers. Around 1,000 people were celebrating when two armed attackers opened fire. One gunman was killed at the scene. The second, identified as Naveed Ekram, was disarmed, wounded, arrested, and remains in critical condition. Police are still working to identify the identity of the other shooter who was killed. There are also reports that authorities later discovered what appeared to be explosive devices in a vehicle nearby, suggesting that the attack could have been much worse. Australian officials declared the shooting a terrorist attack targeting the Jewish community, calling it a deliberate act of anti-Semitic violence. Now let's ask some questions. Firstly, how did the shooters get the guns? Australia's gun laws are widely regarded as some of the strictest in the entire world. Born from the horror of the 1996 Port Arthur massacre that killed 35 people. In response, the National Firearms Agreement sharply limited ownership of automatic and semi-automatic weapons and instituted tough licensing requirements, mandatory safety training, and buybacks of prohibited firearms. But certain weapons are legally accessible. The suspected weapons in this shooting, like a rifle and shotgun, are legally accessible in Australia to licensed hunters and sport shooters under very strict regulation. So these guns were not military-grade, illegally imported weapons. These were weapons that already exist within Australia's regulated system. Now, the event, of course, is being weaponized to demonize both Muslims and Islam because of the identity of one of the shooters, Naveed Ekram. As usual, Zionists are propagating the message that Islam is somehow responsible for this terror, and that Palestine, as a sort of extension of Islam, is complicit. Zionists are using this propaganda to pressure the Australian Prime Minister to reverse his nation's decision to recognize Palestine. The Zionists also plan to use this opportunity to crack down on pro-Palestine protests and demonstrations. Just this past August, Australia held its largest ever Palestine march, with up to 300,000 people attending to advocate for Palestinian human rights and self-determination amidst the genocide in Gaza. A month after this massive demonstration, Australia recognized the state of Palestine. One of the victims from today's shooting, Rabbi Eli Schlengler, had sent the Australian Prime Minister a letter at the time urging him to reverse his decision. Quote, Rabbi Eli Schlengler, a Shabbat rabbi and emissary, had recently sent a letter to Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. In the letter, written after Australia recognized a Palestinian state, Schlengler urged Albanese not to betray the Jewish people and called on him to reverse the decision. Today, Rabbi Eli Schlengler was murdered, along with 10 others, at a Hanukkah event he organized, killed in cold blood for being Jewish in Australia. Now, the Zionists are going to have a really difficult time trying to paint this as an Islamic-inspired act of terrorism. One of the shooters, Naveed Ekram, was disarmed in an act of selfless bravery by this man. Right-wing outlets and accounts began celebrating the man as a hero, with some offering to buy him a beer, and other Zionist accounts claiming that he was a brave Jew.
אני ראיתי בדרך הנה סרטון של יהודי שמתנפל על אחד המרצחים, שומט ממנו את הנשק ומציל מי יודע כמה נפשות.
It turned out, however, that he was a Syrian-Australian Muslim named Ahmed. He risked his life taking two bullets in the arm in order to disarm the shooter. He is now currently recovering in the hospital.
We're just learning some details about him because he has been shot. Now, we are confident in saying that that is him. He's one of his relatives has just spoken to one of our reporters. We've got an interview coming in. We understand that this gentleman's name is Ahmed Al Ahmed. He's a 43-year-old married father of two. He raced in to help. Apparently owns a fruit shop in Sutherland. No experience with guns. He was just walking past. We are told that he has two bullets in his arm, but they think he's going to be okay. Let's have a listen to the hero's relatives talking about his acts this evening at Bondi Beach.
We see on the social media, he's like, he's 100% hero. Yeah, he have two shots, one in his arm here and one in his hand.
In a moment defined by fear, this Muslim, Ahmed, acted without hesitation, saving lives before police could even reach the attacker. The Zionists are so desperate to make this about Islam and Muslims, but will struggle to do so given that it was a Muslim who stood in the way of God knows how many more victims. Going back to the rabbi who was shot and killed, it turns out that he was actually an avid supporter of the genocide in Gaza. He even traveled to occupied Palestine and partied with IDF soldiers mere hours before they were ordered to enter Gaza for their ethnic cleansing campaign. He also took a video of himself in the West Bank overlooking an illegal Jewish settlement.
A very, very high peak, and from here you can see half the country. Unbelievable place. Can you imagine if this was in the hands of the Arabs. This is right in the heart of the West Bank. This is why this needs to be in the hands of the Jewish people, because of its security, and obviously the obvious, because it belongs to us, because it's our land.
And in response to a post about the Israeli-engineered famine in Gaza, he simply replied that the evidence was AI. Also present at the shooting was the so-called human rights lawyer, Arsen Ostrovsky, who also advocated strongly for the genocide in Gaza for 2 years. He also tried very hard to justify Israel's attacks on the many hospitals in the Gaza Strip. Arsen claimed that a bullet hit him in the head and caused him to bleed. He immediately dropped to the ground and took a selfie, wrote the captions, "Help me," and then uploaded it to social media. Kind of a strange thing to do mid-shooting. Now, as we discussed earlier, this event is being weaponized and politicized for political gain. Israel's prime minister publicly accused Australia's leadership of fostering a climate of hatred.
Sent Prime Minister Albanese of Australia a letter in which I gave him warning that the Australian government's policy was promoting and encouraging anti-Semitism in Australia. I wrote, "Your call for a Palestinian state pours fuel on the anti-Semitic fire. It rewards Hamas terrorism. It emboldens those who menace Australian Jews and encourages the Jew hatred now stalking your streets."
This is obviously absurd, but you can expect the Zionists to continue driving this point home in order to achieve their goals. Dr. Rahma wrote on X, translation, "We warned you not to recognize Palestine, so now you must protect us from anti-Semitism, or you too will need protecting. Your punishment is to restrict your nation's civil liberties and be treated like an occupied territory, silenced, monitored, and policed." Another user tweeted, "A guest on Sky News, speaking about the Bondi Beach attack, draws a reckless and false parallel, suggesting pro-Palestine rallies and chants like 'From the River to the Sea' are clear calls to kill Jews worldwide." The presenter does not push back. This is disgusting.
I have to call it what it is, pro-Palestinian rallies. When they hear "death to Jews, gas the Jews, and from the river to the sea," which is a clear directive, kill Jews worldwide. Globalize the Intifada means kill Jews wherever you are.
And this tweet here by Candace Owens from a few weeks ago is now going viral. They have been signaling a 9/11 style attack is coming the second week of December. Save this tweet, it will age well. The shooting took place on December 14th, the final day of the second week of December. It's too soon, of course, to speculate, but anytime you have a mass shooting like this, you have to question nefarious actors like intelligence agencies. And there are some interesting questions swirling around. For example, an IDF soldier asked, "Do you think Iran is behind the Sydney attack?" An Iranian Twitter user replied, "I got fatigue of Israeli Jews constantly trying to agitate the Goyim to bomb my country. The shooter, Naveed Ekram, is literally a Pakistani from Lahore. Both shooters went to the Salafi sectarian MI6-funded El Murad Institute. On the bookshelf, you can see titles by Ibn Baz, Al Uthaymin, and other slimeball authors associated with Saudi Wahhabi Salafism, a sect that is openly hostile to Iran, Iranian people, Iranian culture, Shia Islam, and the Iranian state. Tired of this stupid bullshit over and over and over and over again, and dumbasses keep falling for it. These shootings are intentional and designed to distract people from Israel's crimes and point the finger at people and countries Israel wants to destroy." There are also reports that the shooter's name may have been Googled in Israel a day before the shooting. One of the perpetrators of the Bondi Beach attack in Sydney, Australia, was Googled in Tel Aviv on December 13th, one day before the attack. Now, this is something that was claimed about the DC shooter with the National Guard and Charlie Kirk's assassination. It's very difficult to actually verify this information because of the fact that the data changes either because of traffic or an issue with the algorithm, or perhaps it getting deliberately wiped. There are also time differences to consider as well. So I don't actually know if it's accurate, but I do think it's worth mentioning. Now, if you're interested, you can watch my recent video about the Zionist psyop to demonize Muslims and Islam in order to pit Muslims versus Christians in the West so that they can deflect attention away from Israel. There are a lot of unanswered questions about this shooting. For example, who exactly were the attackers? What was their background? What was their motivation? Were they acting alone? Were they guided by others? Were they manipulated and influenced by other people, perhaps an intelligence agency? Why did they target this specific event? Let me know what you think in the comment section. Is there anything that I'm missing and that I need to be made aware of? All right, in the last 24 hours, we have gained new developments that raise important questions and concerns about the Bondi Beach shooting potentially being a false flag by foreign intelligence agencies and their terrorist proxies. It's going to take a while to get there, but I promise you, if you stick around, not only is it going to get really dark, but it'll start to make sense. I'm going to explain it the best that I can. Okay, firstly, the shooters have been identified as a father-son duo, Sajid Ekrem, 50 years old, and Naveed Ekrem, 24 years old. The father, Sajid, was killed. Naveed is currently in a coma, but is expected to survive. But the biggest information that we're going to focus on today is the claim that they were allegedly affiliated with ISIS. The Prime Minister of Australia, Anthony Albanese, has said the shooters acted alone, but that there's evidence that these people were part of a cell, potentially ISIS. Quote, Naveed, the son, an Australian-born citizen, was investigated by the Australian Security Intelligence Organization for 6 months back in 2019 over close ties to a Sydney-based Islamic State terrorism cell. Authorities feared he was accessing extremist material online and speaking with other radicalized men, but an assessment was made that there was no indication of any ongoing threat or threat of him engaging in violence. Counterterrorism police believed the gunmen pledged allegiance to the ISIS terrorist group prior to carrying out the attack. Two black and white ISIS flags were discovered in the attacker's car, according to a senior official.
They always got the flags, don't they?
Where do you even order such a flag? Like, how do you order that flag and not raise flags about who you are and what you're up to? Like, if you just order it on Amazon and it comes to your door, or first of all, how is it even being sold in places, right? Unless they're like buying the material and stitching it together themselves, the assumption is that they're buying. So where are they buying it from? Who's bringing it to their door? Are they going to a department store and getting it? How is it even on the shelves? So it's just very weird to me that they have the flags at all and that that hadn't raised a flag with intelligence services. I'm not saying I would find it more believable if they carried out an attack and then had the flag with them. I would be very suspicious about that as well. But it is also weird that you have the flag and you just leave it in the car. It's just weird. Why even bring it with you at all? It's so strange. Anyway, there's more to cover. Sajid, the father, was a small business owner, held a gun license for recreational hunting, and legally possessed 6 firearms. He was a member of a gun club and was entitled to a firearm license under state legislation. Just weeks before the mass shooting, Sajid and Naveed had returned to Australia from the Philippines, having visited the island of Mindanao. Now, this part is very important. The Australian Federal Police and Australian Security Intelligence Organization will be closely investigating what the pair were up to in the Southeast Asian nation. Since 2019, the Philippines, especially the island of Mindanao, has gained a reputation for being a hotspot of extremism. An Australian journalist survived after he was shot in the neck in 2017 while covering a battle against ISIS in the territory. There's areas down there that are very dangerous, with training camps and the like. It has become a well-trodden path for Islamic State through Southeast Asia and into the Philippines ever since 2019. Okay, so then it begs the question, if it's a well-trodden path and they went there and then they came home and they were already on the list being investigated, why did that not raise any flag? Like, I mean, just really think about that for a second. Kinda weird. We know this kid has been subjected to extremist material in the past. We know that because we investigated him for 6 months. We know that they went to an island where an Australian journalist was already shot covering battles between the Islamic State extremist group on this island, and this guy and his dad went to this island. Oh my god. Nah, bro. They knew. Come on. I mean, there's a lot more to cover. The mother of Naveed, who is an unemployed bricklayer, said the 24-year-old had told family he had gone to Jervis Bay with his father for a weekend of fishing and swimming. She got lied to, bro. That is not what they were up to. Speaking to the Sydney Morning Herald, she said, he rings me up on Sunday and said, Mom, I just went for a swim. I went scuba diving. We're going to eat now. And then this morning, we're going to stay home now because it's very hot. Yeah, that's not what they did. Verena was unable to identify her son from a photo at the scene of the shooting, but insisted he was a good boy who is incapable of violence or extremism. Okay, this part is very weird to me because the photos of the shooters are actually very clear. So how is she not able to identify her son? So this leads me to believe that maybe it's not even him, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole because I don't have any other evidence to point to that would lead me to believe that. The point of this, though, is just to share with you what the mainstream media is saying and then process that information. So right now we're just going to assume that it is him, but it is weird that she can't identify him through very clear photos. She continues, he doesn't have a firearm. He doesn't even go out. He doesn't mix around with friends. He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't go to bad places, except the island of Mindanao. He goes to work. He comes home. He goes to exercise, and that's it. Verena said Ekdom had worked as a bricklayer until about 2 months ago when the company became insolvent. He attended high school and was not particularly social, she said. He lived at the three two-bedroom Bonnie Rigg home with his parents and younger sister and brother, around which police set up an exclusion zone on Sunday night. Okay, this is also unusual to me, because Navid lives with his mother and father in his family home with his two siblings. And the mother is saying that she could never have imagined that her son would be capable of this. Now, notice how she didn't say that about her husband, though. But setting that aside, it's hard for me to imagine that both the father and the son would carry out an attack like this and have the mother be so completely oblivious that she couldn't even imagine it as a possibility. Assuming they have a good relationship, if you love your wife, if you love your mother, if you love your family and you're close, how could you go out and carry out an attack like this that could lead to your death or life in prison and have it ruin the life of your family? Very strange to me. Okay, so now that we know what the mainstream media is saying about the shooters, that they were a father-son duo, that they pledged allegiance to ISIS, that they visited an ISIS island in the Philippines, let's explore the possibility of this potentially being a false flag. Now, before I continue, I just want to say very clearly that I'm not going to give you any direct information or evidence that proves that this was in fact a false flag. But what I am going to do is give you very well-documented evidence that you've probably come across before that confirms this is within the realm of possibility. You're not crazy, you're not anti-Semitic for thinking that Israel and its intelligence agencies or the US and the CIA is potentially involved in this. You are not crazy, and I'm going to prove to you how. So firstly, in general, terrorist groups are often manipulated or co-opted to serve the interests of intelligence agencies and the governments that they represent. It doesn't matter if it's the CIA, MI6, Mossad, or any other nation. This is not conspiracy or speculation. It's well-documented fact, and I'm going to be walking you through some evidence. For example, in the 1980s, the US government hired the University of Nebraska in Omaha to produce and distribute tens of millions of textbooks for schools that radicalized young Afghani children to emphasize and believe in religious war and violence against the Soviets. Okay, so in case you didn't digest that, I'm going to repeat it for you. The US government hired an American university to produce textbooks for young children to indoctrinate them with hyper-focused interpretations of their religion that emphasizes religious war, aka jihad. They had little children looking at pictures of this and this. They were producing child soldiers to fight and die in their proxy war against the Soviet Union. Even though the Soviet Union retreated from Afghanistan, the program continued until the mid-2000s. During this time, Al-Qaeda was formed and several terrorist attacks took place all over the world, including 9/11. In 2010, the LA Times wrote an article about this program. Quote, "I don't think the University of Nebraska has any business teaching kids anywhere in the world how to be killers," said Paul Olson, president of Nebraskans for Peace, an activist group that has been calling on the university to close the center and its program for the last decade. As evidence, Olson points to the center's $60 million contract with the U.S. government in the 1980s to educate Afghan refugees who were living in Pakistan during the Soviet occupation. It printed millions of textbooks that featured material developed by the Mujahideen resistance groups, including images of machine guns and calls for jihad against the Soviets. So to summarize, the United States was producing the language and the material that educated the children to become the jihadis that formed Al-Qaeda in 1988 and carried out jihadi terror attacks all around the world. This served U.S. imperialist and Zionist interests, not just by defeating the Soviets in Afghanistan, but also by producing the War on Terror, which destabilized South Asia and the Middle East. Afghanistan was invaded and pillaged for 20 years. Iraq was invaded and destroyed, filling it with religious extremist groups raised on the language produced by the U.S. government and this program to produce textbooks, with many of these fighters eventually making their way to countries like Libya and Syria in order to destabilize and destroy it on behalf of NATO and the West. This weakened and fragmented the Middle East, which led to Israel's dominance. In 2016, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said the CIA was responsible for paving the way for ISIS as the whistleblowing organization released more than 500,000 formerly confidential U.S. diplomatic cables dating back to 1979. Quote, Mr. Assange said a decision by the CIA together with Saudi Arabia to plow billions of dollars into arming the Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan to tackle the Soviet Union had led to the creation of the terror group Al-Qaeda. This, in turn, he said, led to the 9/11 terror strike, the invasion of both Afghanistan and Iraq by the U.S., and the creation of ISIS. He added, the invasion of Afghanistan by the USSR would see Saudi Arabia and the CIA push billions of dollars to Mujahideen fighters as part of Operation Cyclone, fomenting the rise of Al-Qaeda and the eventual collapse of the Soviet Union. In short, the U.S. partnership with Saudi Arabia produced this era of so-called Islamic Islamic terror that ultimately saw oil money purchase Western weapons for extremist groups indoctrinated by Western-produced textbooks to carry out destabilizing acts that served their geopolitical agendas. The military-industrial complex made obscene amounts of money, and Israel's position in the region strengthened little by little over the years. Now, there's a lot of focus on the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, so hearing this, you might think, well, the Zionists don't really play much of a role, and they're a junior partner if they're even involved at all. But you're wrong about that. The Mossad is documented not only as collaborating with these forces, but actively taking leadership in them. The head of a right-wing Israeli think tank says the existence of ISIS serves a strategic purpose in the West's interests. This Israeli think tank said, "Don't destroy ISIS, it's a useful tool against Iran, Hezbollah, and Syria." The Israeli defense minister Moshe Yaalon declared that he prefers ISIS over Iran and does not consider ISIS to pose a serious threat to the Israeli state, saying Iran will always remain the main enemy. And journalist and author Whitney Webb wrote for the Mint Press, Israeli website claims ISIS commander revealed as Mossad agent. According to a report from the Israeli website Inyan Merkazi and Abna News Agency, Libyan security forces arrested a Daesh commander in the city of Benghazi, only to find out soon after that the man they had captured, Ephraim Benjamin, was also an agent of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service. Benjamin, who was known in Libya as Abu Hafs, had begun working in Libya after the 2011 NATO-led invasion of Libya that ousted former leader Muammar Gaddafi. Middle East Monitor reported that Hafs, or Benjamin, was said to have become a prominent imam in a Benghazi mosque before becoming a Daesh leader who commanded more than 200 fighters. Now let's pause for a moment to digest all of this. A Jewish Israeli Mossad agent posed as a prominent Libyan imam and then became an ISIS leader in Libya with over 200 fighters at his command. It really makes you wonder, who else could be a Jewish Israeli Mossad agent? Maybe Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the man who supposedly founded ISIS? Jewish Mossad agents are well known for penetrating the structures of terrorist organizations and even nation states in order to serve the interests of Israel. The most famous example is Eli Cohen, the Egyptian Jewish spy who was given a false identity as a Syrian businessman. He moved to Argentina with tons of money and connected with Syrian elites from the Ba'ath Party, offering to help fund their rise to power in Syria. After making himself useful to a minority elite seeking power and gaining their trust, he moved to Syria. A year later, the Ba'ath Party would take power in Damascus. Cohen had gained so much trust and influence that he was on the short list for deputy defense minister before he was eventually exposed and arrested by Syrian intelligence. So, Jewish Israeli Mossad agents have a very long history of infiltrating groups, arming them, and funding them in order to help them take power, exploiting them all for Israel's gain. ISIS is no different. It's no wonder that many people have noticed over the years that ISIS never really seems to attack Israel. I mean, if they are this extremist Islamic jihadist organization, and since Zionist Jews always love to say that Islam hates the West and they hate Judaism and they want to eradicate Jews from the world, why haven't they ever attacked Israel? It's unusual. To quote the Israeli defense minister, ISIS serves their interests against Iran and their other allies. On a larger scale, Daesh ultimately serves to help divide entire nations like Iraq, Syria, and others into pieces. This is a key component of the Israeli strategic plan, otherwise known as the Yunnan plan, to dominate the Middle East by dividing and then conquering its neighbors. Okay, so when you hear that Australian shooters are potentially indoctrinated by extremist language and then potentially even trained on an ISIS island in the Philippines, is it really crazy for us to wonder if the Mossad, the CIA, or Saudi intelligence, or perhaps even all three, are somehow involved in this? I mean, these are the same people doing 60 Minutes interviews where they brag about how the world is a stage and that they're waging war through deception. By the way, 60 Minutes is owned by CBS, which is owned by Israeli agents, and the woman interviewing the Mossad agent is also a Jewish Zionist. Oh my God, we're on to them. This is what the media will never ever tell you. They will never reveal or expose this kind of information to you. They will only give you the surface level that serves their agenda. But not me. I don't mind telling you. Now do you get why my channel faces censorship? Now do you understand why I say I need you to support me by commenting, liking, sharing, and if you want, give your money as well. But anyway, this shooting on Bondi Beach did not take place in a vacuum. Australia recently recognized Palestine. It also hosted its largest ever pro-Palestine march with over 300,000 people calling for Palestinian human rights and self-determination. Since the shooting, Zionist groups and aligned political actors have moved very quickly to pressure the Australian government to reverse the recognition of Palestine, to push for restrictions on pro-Palestine demonstrations and to equate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Now listen, if you are waiting in the near future for information to come out that proves without a doubt that Israel or the CIA was behind this shooting and directly involved in it, let me just break the news to you now. That is not ever going to happen. These organizations operate with multiple degrees of separation for a reason, in order to make any connection speculative at best, and so that they can always just simply deny it. But the information I just shared with you is enough to understand that groups like the CIA and the Mossad have always been involved and will always be involved in one way or another, directly or indirectly, in the activities of these terrorist organizations that are leveraged as proxies to serve their agenda, whether it's against the Russians in Ukraine or Afghanistan, whether it's against Iran in Syria or against Iraq in Libya. These groups serve their interests. So what can you do about it? Awareness is key, and you should be telling as many of your friends as possible in order to wake them up. You can't prevent what they're doing, but you can help prevent what they're trying to achieve. In my previous video, I explored the Zionist psychological operation in order to have the West remember why it hates Muslims by reminding them that radical terrorism, like what took place on Bondi Beach, exists and that it's coming to harm the West, and that Palestine is somehow connected to that kind of terrorism, in order to deflect attention away from Israel and its genocide so that they can salvage their Jewish supremacist state. So the way to resist this is to not allow them to demonize Muslims or Islam. Do not allow them to divide Muslims and Christians and pit them against one another. Do not send your children to war over these lies. Do not allow them to prevent Palestinians from earning their right to self-determination, human rights, and dignity. Never ever believe anything that they say. They've already given you enough reason to know that these are the worst liars in the history of humanity.